This is our Merleau-Ponty group, continuing our reading of The Structure of Behavior. So we are picking up from page 55 of the translation. That's 85 in the PDF, if anyone's following along with the PDF. So we read the introduction of the book last time, and then we skipped chapter one on the reflex theory, and we jumped into chapter two on sort of the higher forms of behavior. The first little bit of chapter two is sort of a recap of some of the arguments of chapter one. So that gives us, I think, enough of what we need from chapter one without going through all the sort of very intricate details of the reflex theory, which, as I mentioned a couple weeks ago, the reflex theory is essentially obsolete in physiology and psychology today. No one actually thinks that this theory is adequate or sort of worth pursuing. So the reflex theory is essentially an account of how complex behavior is built up out of very simple sort of atoms of behavior or units of behavior called reflexes. So the familiar sorts of reflexes are like the way that your pupil will dilate when you enter a dark room and contract when you enter a bright room. So you this is a sort of reaction that happens in response to a stimulus. But it happens without any sort of deliberate decision or intention on the part of the person. And it's even pretty much impossible to prevent yourself from doing this. And this is sort of what characteristic of a reflex is that, it happens sort of automatically without any intention, and it's difficult to suppress. And so the idea of the reflex theory was that all the sort of complicated and seemingly goal-directed behavior that animals, including humans, exhibit, finding food, finding a mate, finding a nesting site, et cetera, all these behaviors are just very complicated forms of reflexes sort of strung together in genes and groups of reflexes. And so for Pavlov, of course, is well known for his concept of the conditioned response. So there are these reflexes that animals have without any form of learning. In the famous case with the dogs that he trained, there was the unconditioned response of the dogs to the smell of meat powder or any other type of food. So this is something a dog doesn't have to learn. It just, you know, without any learning, dogs will respond to the smell of food by salivating. But then if you repeatedly pair the smell of food with the ringing of a bell, the dog eventually sort of learns this connection. And then you can evoke the salivation response just by ringing the bell without the meat powder, without the smell of food. And this is the conditioned response. So this is something that does require learning. And for Pavlov, this is essentially the whole process by means of which complex behaviors are built up out of simple ones is conditioned response. So you have these very long chains of conditioned responses that sort of structure that build up the structure of complex behaviors out of these simple unconditional responses. Merleau-Ponty has a number of criticisms of this theory, but the one that he presents in the bit that we read last time has to do with some of the empirical results of looking at the way that different stimuli can be inhibiting or excitatory. So depending on how you combine different stimuli, sometimes you can have one stimulus that will bring about a certain response on its own, but then when you present another stimulus at the same time, the second stimulus will inhibit the first one. So it means it doesn't produce the same response, or it produces a weaker version of the same response. And so what happens if you have like groups of stimuli? So you have like, say, a light and a sound and a smell all at the same time. And you try to figure out, you know, which ones are excitatory, which ones are inhibitory, how much inhibition and excitation do each of these stimuli evoke in the animal. If you try to assign quantities to these excitation and inhibition effects, what happens is you can't, there's actually no consistent set of quantities you can assign that reproduces all the results that you want. So like, on page, what page is it? On page 53, there's a little table of the different quantities that that you get with the, like, if you have three types of stimulus, I think it's a light, the sound of a metronome, and then I forget what S is, but anyway, there's like three different stimuli, and the different combinations of these stimuli produce different degrees of salivation in the dog. But if you try to like solve the system of equations here, there's actually no consistent values you can assign to the variables L, M, and S. And what Pavlov's response to this is he says we, oh, S is sound, right? Yeah, and M is a metronome. Yeah, thanks. Yeah, so then Pavlov's response to this is to say, actually, we need to introduce a new law of how reflexes interact. So there's not just this spreading. So the first two laws are the spreading of excitation. So whenever there's a response from, like, when A evokes response B, then everything that accompanies A will also evoke response B. This is sort of just the general form of what conditioned responses, the form of what a conditioned response is. And then there's also this law of inhibition that means that, yeah, you can have this inhibitory response from one stimulus to another. And then this third law is what he calls, here, the phrase that he uses here is a sort of nerve equilibrium, the nature of which cannot be made any more precise. And so he suggests that there's some sort of state in the nervous system of the animal that brings about some sort of connection between different stimuli in the animal. So it's not just the case that stimulus one and stimulus two each have their own effects, a certain quantity of excitation or inhibition. And then those two quantities are added together to bring about a response of some kind. Instead, there's some sort of connection within the nervous system of the animal between the different responses. What Merleau-Ponty points out is that first, this is like a completely arbitrary attempt to sort of save the theory, because there's no evidence for this interaction or this nerve equilibrium, except for the fact that you need it to sort of make the quantities add up properly. So it's just a sort of ad hoc hypothesis. And then the next sort of point here is that if there is something like this nerve equilibrium or some sort of interaction of the different stimuli with each other, then what this shows is that the stimuli are not actually sort of isolated atoms like the whole theory sort of presents them as. So it's not the case, again, they don't act in an additive way. It's not that S has a certain effect and L has a certain effect, and then those effects are just sort of added up and produce a total response of the organism. Instead, S and L interact with each other, or what is really having an effect on the organism is S and L together. It's the combination of the two. And so the combination of the two is actually a distinct stimulus from each of them in isolation, just added to each other. And so what the sort of lesson that Merleau-Ponty draws is that the real stimulus is not any of the, is not just like each of the individual stimuli and then the sum of those stimuli together. It's the whole set of stimuli. So it's the L plus S plus M all together. One sort of complex stimulus is acting as a whole instead of being sort of built up from its component parts. And so, yeah, we'll see more about what the consequences of this are as we continue the reading today. But we can already see that this is sort of like, you know, if we have to acknowledge this as like the result of what our experiments with conditioning show, then the whole sort of framework of the reflex theory is already falling apart because we're no longer building up complex behaviors out of simple ones. We're instead looking at how a complex stimulus made up of, say, light and sound and smell, how this complex stimulus evokes some sort of response in the animal that might also be complex. And so now we have to look at the whole situation in which the animal or with which the animal is presented. We have to look at every aspect of that situation, and any aspect of that situation could be relevant, and we don't know, like, at the outset which ones are important and which ones are not important. So it makes the whole sort of mode of explanation much more complicated, and it means we have to sort of pay attention to things that we otherwise might not have paid attention to. Right, so I think that's mostly what we talked about last week. So we can start on the reading for this week. So if I can get a volunteer to read from page 55, I believe we're on the bottom paragraph, so starting from "It has been possible."
Okay, I can read if you want.
Sure, thanks.
"It has been possible to give a conditioned power to a constellation of excitants, each of which remains inhibiting when taken separately. The series, light, high-pitched sound, low-pitched sound contact can be reflexogenic, while the series, light, low-pitched sound, high-pitched sound contact is not. One can obtain a reaction for two successive sounds of the same pitch and an equal intensity going from the less to the more intense, while the same sounds in the inverse order produce no effect. The reaction persists if the absolute tone of these sounds is modified, provided the difference of their intensities is maintained constant. An early work has shown that an octopus, after having acquired a positive reaction to a large receptacle in which it finds its food and apparently an inhibition to a smaller receptacle presented at the same time as the first, nevertheless visits the smaller one when it is presented alone. The genuine excitant of the conditioned reactions is neither a sound nor an object considered as individuals, nor an assemblage of sounds or objects considered as groups, which are both individual and confused, but rather the temporal distribution of sounds, their melodic sequence, and the relations of size of objects, and, in general, the precise structure of the situation. Far from being a faithful description of behavior, the theory of conditioned reflexes is a construction inspired by the atomistic postulates of realistic analysis. It carries over into organic activity the modes of cleavage, which are appropriate to a universe of things and in no way represents the necessary instruments of a scientific investigation. One can easily date these postulates. They belong to a bygone period of physiology and psychology. We would find them again. Pavlov himself draws this parallel if we attempted to analyze perception from within. Psychologists such as Helmholtz, dealing with the constancy of the apparent size of objects, suppose that an unconscious conclusion allowed us to discover their true size behind the image whose size varies with the distance. Pavlov suggests that retinal excitations evoked by the same object at different distances have become the conditioned stimuli of motor reactions of palpation executed when the object is within touching distance. The mode of thinking in the two cases is the same. One begins by supposing that individual images of different dimensions are given, quote-unquote, in consciousness, or that physiological processes with no common measure are given in the organism for its perception of an object whose distance varies. And the problem is then to find the means of unifying these mental or physiological individuals in an intellectual operation or in some associative connection. But the question would not be posed in this way, and these solutions would not have to be considered had we not begun by treating respectively the quote-unquote mental images of the same object or the physiological processes which it elicits in the nervous systems as so many separated realities. If structure had been chosen as the guiding concept in psychology and in physiology and not the atom. Do I keep reading? Or?
Yeah, we can stop here, actually. This is a good point, I think. we can see already here that there's a couple of sort of key concepts of this book that he's introducing sort of quickly, but obviously he's going to develop a lot more what these mean. So this notion of structure, it's already in the title of the book, is going to be obviously a key notion. And where he talks about the melodic sequence at the top of 56. So the immediate application of this concept, of course, is to sounds. In the example he mentions, a high-pitched sound followed by a low-pitched sound can produce a certain response, whereas the low-pitched sound followed by a high-pitched sound produces a different response or no response at all. So here, it's clear that it's not each of the sounds sort of in isolation that's producing a response. It's actually the sequence, high pitch followed by low pitch, that is producing a response. And so the animal here is responding not to it, each individual stimulus as a sort of atom. It's responding to the structure or this melodic sequence of the stimuli. And so he's going to, later on, we'll see more on this notion of a melodic sequence. He's going to sort of generalize from this example. And so a melodic sequence will not just be in the realm of sound, but any sort of temporal structure of a situation will be described as a melodic sequence. And so this is already something that is a little bit hard to explain from a sort of atomistic perspective. So if each stimulus is just an atom, sort of self-contained whole, and each has its own effect, and then the result is just the sum of the effects of each of the atoms, then it shouldn't really matter which stimulus comes first and which comes second. Like this, when you're doing sums of numbers, obviously it doesn't matter if you do 3 + 4 or 4 + 3. So here we have something different than just purely the sum of the effects of the stimuli. And it's already like, as soon as you recognize something like a structure or a melodic sequence of stimuli as capable of having an effect on an organism as such, it's actually the structure that has the effect and not the individual stimuli that have the effect, then it's clear that we can't understand the effect in a sort of purely mechanistic sense in the way that Pavlov wants to do. So we can't just take it that there's a sort of quasi-physical effect of light on the organism and of sound on the organism, and then the effect, those two physical effects are added together. We have to instead, the organism is already grasping something in a maybe not quite intellectual sense, but is at least recognizing something as having a structure when it responds to a high pitch followed by a low pitch and not to a low pitch followed by a high pitch. So it's already, there's something like a sense, that might be too strong a word, but at least a structure, a sort of direction of the situation that the organism is responding to, as opposed to just a mechanical action of physical influences on organs of the organism. And so this is sort of one of the key notions of this book, is this notion that there's already, even at the level, the very basic level of, you know, responding to one sequence of tones and not another sequence, already at this level, there's something like a grasping on the part of the organism. The organism is understanding something as opposed to just sort of passively being influenced by physical forces or properties or whatever. So he points out that this sort of reflex theory, like Pavlov's version of the reflex theory, sort of claims to be a description of behavior, a sort of purely descriptive account of behavior. But it actually incorporates some important theoretical presuppositions that turn out to be hard to maintain because of some of these interactions of stimuli that we've talked about. So and he compares this to earlier, like 19th century psychology, where in general there's this presupposition that what is given in the mind or consciousness or whatever term we want to use is something like an image. It's like a sort of static representation of something outside of us that is produced by objects or forces or whatever outside of us. So like light strikes our retina in some mysterious way. This brings about the formation of a visual image in our mind. And then that visual image is what is given to us. It's essentially like a photograph inside your mind. And the problem is then, how do we get from these sort of flat, two-dimensional, static photographs, how do we get from that to our experience of the world as a three-dimensional world of objects and motion of objects, et cetera, all the different things that make the world sort of dynamic and structured. And the sort of standard response is something like inference. We infer. So we have, for example, when we see a distant object and we recognize that it's actually a normal size object seen at a distance and not a small version of the object, what we're doing is we are sort of, we have our very small visual image of the object in our minds, and then we infer that the production of that visual image is a result of some sort of optical properties that make it seem small. And so this, again, the sort of mode of explanation is you're given these images in your mind and you have to infer what is the cause or what is the reality behind these images, using some sort of inferential process. And
he's gone. Well, I think he's probably going to join in again soon. Yeah, there he is.
Sorry, I don't know what happened there. Discord just died all of a sudden. Hopefully everyone can hear me now. Yeah, okay, good. So I was just saying, this mode of explanation through inference was sort of the popular version in the 19th century. But the sort of reflex theory explanation is the same type of structure, except inference is now replaced by some form of conditioned response or association. So we still have these sort of static elements, these atoms in the mind or within the organism, and then the problem is how are they sort of connected to each other, or how do they combine to form our complex set of responses to the world, even other animals that we might regard as simple. Insects, for example, have a very structured and complex response to the world, as opposed to just exhibiting very simple reflexes. So we start with these sort of static isolated elements, and then we have to sort of combine them together in some way to bring about, to reconstruct the complex and dynamic relationship to the world that we find in our experience. So Merleau-Ponty wants to sort of contest the starting point of this form of explanation. So we shouldn't be thinking of psychological explanation as starting from these sort of images in the mind or these effects in the organism, and then try to reconstruct the complex and dynamic nature of experience. We should actually start from experience as something structured that has this melodic quality to it, this temporal structure, for example. We should start from that and use that as our basis of explanation. And we'll see later in the book, you know, what exactly that means.
Okay, so I guess he's having trouble with Discord disconnecting him. Okay, there he is. Yeah, I think that was a really good explanation, and we can probably, if anyone has any questions, we could answer it. If not, maybe we could go on, right?
Is there, does somebody need to read it?
Yeah, so normally how we do it is we just go around and people will read a page or two, and then we stop and explain and discuss, and you know, if people have questions, we can go over them. Say that again.
Which paragraph moment?
We are at the bottom of page 56, so it may seem astonishing.
Okay.
So if I can get another volunteer to read the next page or so, unless there are any other questions or comments about the last bit.
I do have a little bit, because you said an example about, I think it's not just the past paragraph, about the difference between 3 plus 4 versus 4 plus 3. Maybe it has something to do with this level of representation, like how it's mentioned either images or something is inferred by the number. But I was thinking about an example of 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1 versus 3 plus 4. Isn't that sounds more of like a example about this paragraph, or am I going to?
So the reason I mentioned this sort of example of how 3 plus 4 and 4 plus 3 are the same is so that if we think of these if we think of experience being built up out of these atoms that each have their own individual effect, and then the connection of these atoms, or like the way that these atoms sort of build up more complex structures, is just a summation or addition. So each has one effect that has a certain, you can call it 5 or 3 or whatever. And then the second one has another effect, like 4 or -1 or some other quantity. And you just add those two together to get the result. If that's how they work, then it shouldn't matter what order the stimuli come in. So it should be just a sum, stimulus 1 plus stimulus 2 should be the same result as stimulus 2 plus stimulus 1, whatever quantity they have.
But the author themselves don't place any emphasis on the order.
So what Merleau-Ponty here is pointing out is that Pavlov's theory, the reflex theory that he's criticizing, doesn't sort of make a place for the order of the stimuli, even though when you actually do these experiments, it turns out that the order actually does matter. So you can, for example, bring about salivation in the dog. You can train a dog to salivate when it hears a high tone followed by a low tone, but then not to salivate if it hears a low tone followed by a high tone. So you can train the dog to recognize the order of those tones and, more complex melodies and other temporal structures. So the dog is capable of recognizing the sequence of tones and not just responding to each tone in isolation and then sort of summing the effects of each of those tones.
Okay. I guess maybe the author makes a difference between a very basic level of association versus different kinds of association. It's like an isolated sense of association versus there's more than just one event and another event. There's two. It's more than two events that's happening, because the observation of the sequence itself is an event that happens in the dog at that moment, right?
Right. And so the idea, what Merleau-Ponty is sort of pointing out here is that the dog is not just responding to is not just a simple stimulus having a simple effect and then sort of adding these simple effects together. It's the dog is having some sort of response to a complex stimulus that already has structure. The dog is recognizing the structure as such. So it's in this case, it's a temporal structure. So it's a sequence of one tone followed by another tone. But it could also be like in the other example that he mentioned previously, it was the combination of a sound and a smell and a light all at the same time. And so the dog is capable of recognizing, these sort of three things all at the same time mean food and therefore salivation. You can have and obviously these are still relatively simple examples. I'm sure you can train a dog to recognize like a more complex melody, like a particular song, for example, and not just a sequence of two tones.
I think I understand about the two event versus atomic, because I think there's some mention of these atomic events, but they don't really quite go into of how these atomic events is working against Pavlov's theory instead of working for it. But yeah, I think I understand.
Right.
I can read for the. Did you say the read the next paragraph or next or
next page or so? I think it's good. Whenever you, we can read. So there's on the next page. There's this part in smaller print. If you read to the end of the bit that's in smaller print, so it's like about a page and a half onto page 58. That would be great.
I guess there's no more questions. Like, should I start?
So you can start from "it may seem astonishing" and then to the end of the bit in smaller print.
It may seem astonishing that Pavlov, determined to found a science behavior and in order to remain close to the facts, to accept only physiological explanation, should have introduced the postulates of the old psychology into his research. This is because, in reality, physiological explanation cannot be direct in Pavlov or anywhere else. As far as Pavlov is concerned, the arbitrariness of his physiological schemata is not so apparent in the simple example, which served as in describing term, but it becomes so when we confront them with certain complex levels of to which Pavlov himself attempted to apply them. He observes astonishing behavior in dogs submitted to repeat experiment. As soon as the apparatus which permits the gathering of the secretion is put in place, the animal falls into a state comparable to hypnosis. Presented with a conditioned stimulus, the dog responds by the ordinary secretory reaction, but on the other hand, the motor reaction do not take. Presented with the unconditioned exit, the morsel of meat. What is morsel?
Morsel is just like a piece of meat.
Okay, sure. I've never seen that. The animal does not react in the ordinary way. Sometimes the salivary secretion is normal, but the movements of mastication are not produced. Sometimes, on the contrary, the dog eats the food, but the salivary secretion is delayed for 10 or 20 seconds. Let us examine the explanation which Pavlov gives of this last case. For him, the setting up of the conditioned reflex consists in a connection which is established between the cortical center, which receives the conditioned stimulus, the one which governs the movements of mastication, and a subcortical center on which the alimentary secretion depends. Thus, this behavior disorder will be designated as a dissociation of the motor and secretory reaction. No attempt is made to resituate this disorder in its biological context in order to discover a general alteration of behavior through these differences. The observed attitudes will be interpreted by saying that the secretory center is inhibited while the motor center is not. But this elective inhibition is itself in need of explanation. From this follow two hypotheses which we have no other reason for assuming. First, Pavlov posits a general inhibition of the brain, which starting from the points corresponding to the artificial condition reflexes, has been extended to the subcortical center, which governs the salivary secretions, and to the cortical motor analyzer. After having introduced a total inhibition which is not revealed by observation, Pavlov suggests that the sight of the meat initially leaves the inhibition of the secretory center intact and surmounts that of the motor center, which he says is more mobile than the other. This greater mobility is posited because of the demands of the... When he brings it into play, Pavlov does not explain the phenomenon. He only describes in anatomical and physiological terms a disinhibition, which is itself posited and transcribes a process which is problematic in itself onto a language still more problematic. There's a footnote here. Is this the end of...
No, yeah, you can keep going to the end. It's like another half page.
In speaking just now of the biological context of these disorders, we alluded to the negativistic attitude which Pavlov also described, but for which he seeks a separate explanation. The dog, in a state of hypnosis, turns its head away when the morsel of meat is offered to it on the first, second, or even third presentation. As soon as the food is taken away, however, it turns its head into the direction of the platter and follows it with its eyes. In the most favorable cases, it finally opens and encloses its mouth with great difficulty and the inhibition disappears. In order to explain these attitudes, Pavlov will bring into play a complicated system of excitation, inhibition, and disinhibition. He begins by defining the state of hypnosis or inhibition as a paradoxical phase in which the thresholds of the cerebral cells are lowered, so much so that a strong stimulus then acts like a too powerful stimulus and it provokes an inhibition. He suggests, on the other hand, that the motor center concerned in the reactions includes a positive innervation which releases the movements towards the meat, and a negative innervation, which on the contrary governs the movements of abduction. Once these hypotheses are made, the negativistic attitude will be explained in the following manner. The visual excitation provoked by the terminate according to the established condition at the positive innervation, but they find it in a paradoxical state and thus evoke an inhibition in conformity with the law of reciprocal induction. The inhibition of the positive point evokes an inhibition of the negative. The animal turns away from the meat. When the experimenter withdraws, the positive point, strongly inhibited until then, will of itself pass onto a state of excitation in conformity with the law of internal reciprocal induction. In the same way, the negative point stimulated during the first phase passes into a state of inhibition and tends to evoke the excitation of the positive by reciprocal induction. Doubly stimulated, the latter will doubly stimulated, the latter will initially evoke movements towards the meat when it is withdrawn, and after two or three presentations will evoke the normal motor reflex, at which point the negativistic attitudes comes to.
Right, thanks. Yeah, that's the ending point that I pointed out. So yeah, this bit is a little bit complicated, but it's also part of the point here is precisely that the explanation is so complicated. So what Maître Ponty is sort of exhibiting here is the fact that Pavlov has to introduce all these extra hypotheses that are essentially arbitrary and ad hoc just to explain this strange phenomenon that happens with these dogs that he's training. So as a sort of summary, so when he's doing these conditioning experiments on these dogs, what happens in some cases is that these dogs, instead of exhibiting the normal response to meat or the conditioned response to, these poor dogs, I know. So instead of exhibiting the normal response to meat or to the conditioned response to the stimuli that accompany the meat, instead they exhibit what he describes as a state similar to hypnosis. So the dogs sort of become paralyzed. They can't really do anything. They just sort of sit there and we can, I guess, imagine these dogs are confused or disturbed in an emotional way or something. They don't know what's going on, and so they don't know how to respond. Yeah, they're overwhelmed. So Pavlov needs to sort of come up with an explanation in his terms and in the terms of this reflex theory of what's going on when these dogs are stuck in this weird state. And so he appeals to this idea that there are these sort of complex interactions of inhibition. So there's inhibition and then disinhibition. There's an inhibition of inhibition. So essentially he postulates that for whatever reason, the dog ends up in what he calls this paradoxical state, so that what normally would have an excitatory response, so a stimulus that normally would evoke a response in the dog, now has an inhibitory effect. So it prevents the dog from responding. And he doesn't give any sort of explanation of why this paradoxical state should happen or what sort of the biological significance of this paradoxical state is. He just postulates that it happens. Based on the existence of this paradoxical state, he then gives an explanation of how the dog of why the dog's response is the way that it is. So it first sort of ignores the meat, and then when you withdraw it, then it starts to follow it with its eyes, because now the stimulus is weaker, so it has less inhibitory effect essentially in this paradoxical state. Again, Maître Ponty's objection here is essentially that this is a completely ad hoc hypothesis, as opposed to essentially what you're doing is just re-describing the behavior of the dog in sort of quasi-physiological terms, as opposed to giving a proper, a real biological or physiological explanation of the whole process of what's happening with this dog. You're just sort of re-describing it in this complex sort of physiological sounding language without really giving an adequate explanation of, you know, how this paradoxical state comes about in the first place, you know, what role it plays in the life of a dog in general, and so on.
I have a, like, I don't even know if I really understand the later part of this paragraph. Is Pavlov kind of introducing a paradoxical state where there could be inhibition of inhibition, and then that will be an excitation, but that kind of excitation has to be checked with whether it conforms with the situation or not? Like, there's supposed, like, I don't know if there's supposed, like, this experiment supposed and capability of expecting for the dogs, like, because it talk about especially this part, like, when the experimenter withdraws the meat, the positive point strongly inhibited until then will of itself pass onto the state of excitation in conformity with the law of internal reciprocal induction. This is the part where I think it just completely throws the things off, but maybe there's like a expectation when it says internal reciprocal induction.
Right, yeah. So
saying that there is a paradoxical state where the dog need to actually check the expectation, because that's what I'm hearing. Like, oh, inhibition of inhibition, maybe it has to check with the stimulus from the excitation to see if it's true excitation or not.
Yeah, so I think the theory can't really, so this reflex theory can't appeal to a notion like expectation, because that's already something sort of cognitive and sophisticated. It, like, if you say the dog is expecting something, you're already sort of attributing relatively sophisticated intellectual capacities to the dog. And the goal of the reflex theory is precisely to explain those sophisticated intellectual capacities in terms of much more simple capacities like these reflex responses. So I think the idea here instead is to, this paradoxical state, what it means is essentially that when the dog is in this state, in this sort of mysterious state that Pavlov assumes without really any explanation, when the dog is in this state, then the stimuli that normally would excite a response are instead inhibitory. So it prevents the dog from responding. So in this case, the meat, normally a dog would respond to meat with salivation and other, would try to grab the meat and try to eat it and so on. But when the dog is in this paradoxical state, it instead responds with inhibition. So it instead, the stimulus, the presence of the meat, brings about an inhibition of response. So the dog is not capable of performing all these motor responses, like trying to grab the meat, trying to eat it, and so on. What Pavlov is trying to explain on the basis of this paradoxical state is that when the meat is sort of presented to the dog, it doesn't take it. But then once you move the meat away from the dog, then the dog does start to exhibit responses to the meat, like following it with its eyes. And then eventually it will start to, exhibit the normal motor responses. And so the idea is that when the meat is close to the dog, when it's presented to the dog, the stimulus is very strong. And then in this paradoxical state, it means that the inhibition is very strong. And then when the stimulus is further away, the stimulus is less strong, so there's less inhibition, so the normal motor responses can actually come out.
Okay.
But again, this whole explanation depends on this presence of this paradoxical state that he just sort of postulates without any justification or any sort of explanation of, you know, why would a dog ever sort of enter this paradoxical state in the first place?
And what is the internal induction? Is there a previous one?
So this is another one. So Pavlov has these laws of how these different stimuli relate to each other. And if I remember correctly, internal reciprocal induction was that, it has to do with the way that responses that are, how does he state it? So if you have something that is inhibitory of a response, so if, for example, if an electric shock applied to the dog makes it withdraw from the meat, or not respond to the meat, which is probably the case. So that electric shock is inhibitory. Then if you remove the inhibition, then the excitatory response comes back or appears where it wasn't present. So it's a sort of reciprocal induction. So the removal of an inhibition has mm-hmm. the same effect as the presence of an excitation, essentially.
Okay.
But yeah, you can already, I mean, the very specific details of this theory are not that important, but the sort of general lesson I think that we're supposed to draw from this example is that these sort of physiological explanations like Pavlov's, there's a sort of constant danger that what you do when you're trying to explain something in terms of a physiological theory like this is you're essentially just taking the phenomenon you're trying to explain and you just sort of translate it into physiological language. And then you have to postulate these things like this paradoxical phase or these sort of strange phenomena that you have no evidence for except for the fact that you needed to make your theory work. People like Pavlov claim to be doing, you know, very scientific physiology and to be more sort of rigorous than people that want to study organisms in their natural environment, for example. But we see in this type of explanation that what they're doing is actually not quite as rigorous as they are claiming to be. So that it requires these arbitrary assumptions and then these sort of strange hypotheses to make sure that the assumptions match the experimental results. In these sort of strange cases like the dogs that exhibit this hypnosis effect. It's sort of the general lesson is a kind of critical analysis of attempts to explain behavior, even in other animals, but especially in humans, in this strictly physiological mechanistic sense, because often when you try to do that, you are essentially just translating the problem into different words and then treating that translation as a solution to the problem. Right, yeah. And so as Bats has put in the chat here, so the big issue is that we don't know by which mechanism the excitation becomes too strong. Yeah, so we have no, in Pavlov's theory or his explanation of this phenomenon of the hypnotized dogs, he gives us no explanation of how is it that the dog enters this paradoxical state in the first place or, you know,
It's like an explanation that demands much more, so it doesn't really explain.
Yes, exactly. It just sort of pushes the problem back one more step. Like you say, okay, this paradoxical state of the dog explains the weird hypnosis phenomenon. But then the question is, okay, well, why, you know, what is this paradoxical state? Where does it come from? You know, why did dogs exhibit it in the first place? All these questions are not answered. So it just sort of pushes the problem back one step, and then you have all the same questions again.
I don't know if it's having the same question again. It's more of like it's summarizing the question and then refer to a possibly other question that is more explanatory than this set of questions. It's like summarizing it into a question that nobody knows.
Right, yeah. So it's not exactly the same questions, but the same sort of nature of questioning. Like you still need a, like if your goal is like, it, you know, the way that Pavlov's goal is to explain everything in this mechanistic form of explanation, if you sort of postulate that there's this paradoxical state, then we still have the question, you know, what is the mechanistic explanation for this paradoxical state? Like why, what process brings about this paradoxical state in the dog? And he hasn't given us any explanation of that. And it's not obvious, like, what explanation you could give of that in terms of his theory. It sort of raises new questions that are at least as difficult to answer as the first questions. Okay, so are there any other questions or comments about that section before we move on to the next one? Okay, so in that case, I can read the next bit. I'll read to the end of this section on page 60. These examples bring to light the distance which exists between the observable behavior and the anatomical physiological hypothesis by which one tries to account for them. If the term conditioned reflex has any meaning, it should designate a relatively stable reaction linked with certain stimuli. The observation of animals reveals, however, that the reactions are variable and can be disassociated or even reversed. But with the notions of inhibition and reciprocal induction, Pavlov provided himself with the principles which allow him to stop up all the cracks in the theory, as well as to construct an explanation that leaves the notion of conditioned reflex intact. Let me reread that sentence. But with the notions of inhibition and reciprocal induction, Pavlov provided himself with the principles which allow him to stop up all the cracks in the theory, as well as to construct an explanation that leaves the notion of conditioned reflex intact. The mechanisms of excitation, inhibition, and disinhibition which he evokes necessarily appear as expedient devices designed to mask the disagreement between theory and experiment. As long as we have not informed ourselves concerning the processes of cerebral physiology from some other source. A theory which, without experimental support, posits forces in contrary directions evidently escapes being contradicted by experience, since it can always bring into play at the right moment one of the two principles in default of the other. For the same reason, it is not susceptible to any experimental justification. Far from being patterned on the facts, Pavlov's categories are imposed upon them. The terms excitation, inhibition, and disinhibition properly designate certain descriptive aspects of behavior, which are made known to us by our internal and external experiences. On the other hand, inhibition as Pavlov defines it, that is, as a positive nerve process released by certain stimuli, is a physical mechanical symbol which should not profit from the same evidential privilege. Because he carried descriptive notions found in the observation of behavior directly into the central nervous system, Pavlov was able to believe that he employed a physiological method. In reality, it amounts to an imaginary physiology, and it could not be otherwise. For a physiological method which appears to be recommended by the best scientific spirit is in reality the one which asks the most of conjectures and is the least direct of all. There is an equivocation on the meaning of the term, quote, physiological fact, unquote. Sometimes it is used to designate phenomena directly observed in the brain, sometimes and more generally those which the analysis of behavior leads us to posit behind the actions of animals and men. And the privilege of objectivity is transferred to, quote, physiological fact, unquote, in the second sense of the word, which it has only in the first sense. Moreover, a realistic prejudice is operative here. If we had a precise knowledge of the physiological phenomena of which the nervous system is the seat, to be guided by them in the analysis of behavior would be indicated. But in fact, what we know about nerve functioning directly comes down to very little. One can wonder in all justice whether, in physiological knowledge, objectivity is not confused with the methods of physical and chemical measurement. The application of physical and chemical excitants and the measurement of chronaxes allow us to note certain effects of nerve activity under determined conditions, which conditions, moreover, are rather different from those of its normal exercise. It is not certain that nerve functioning can be adequately characterized in this way. In the present state of our knowledge, in any case, whether we examine the organism by means of the observation of behavior or by means of the measurement of reactions evoked in it by certain physical and chemical agents, only the manifestations of nerve functioning are grasped, and the two procedures are equally indirect. Inferences are equally necessary in both cases. In this situation, the more one is aware of the indirect character of physiological knowledge, the less there is risk of error. Consequently, one can presume that such risk is at a maximum in those who, like Pavlov, pretend to start from physiology. Since nobody can, in fact, start with physiology, Pavlov begins with a study of behavior, with a description of the reactions of the organism in the presence of certain situations, in spite of his own principles. And since he is not sufficiently aware of the constructive character of his physiology, he founds it on the least defensible principles of the older psychology. A deliberately descriptive and psychological method would offer more guarantees. It remains for us to justify these criticisms of principle and to disengage a positive conception by analyzing some results of modern investigations concerning central nerve functioning and concerning the development of behavior. Right, so this bit is essentially a summary of some of the sort of main lessons from the criticism of Pavlov in the rest of the reading that we've gone through today. So the sort of general criticism is that what Pavlov is doing is not really physiological. Or it's not sort of directly based on physiology in the sense that Pavlov thinks it is, because our knowledge of the nervous system, and especially, you know, in the 1920s, 1930s, when these theories are being developed, the knowledge of the nervous system is so limited that we can't just sort of start from the functioning of the nervous system and sort of build up our explanation of behavior from that. Instead, what we are doing, whether we sort of know it or not, whether we're deliberately aware of it or not, what we're doing is starting from the behavior of organisms and then sort of postulating these principles of explanation in the nervous system of what brings about that behavior. And so because Pavlov is not aware that he's doing this, it means that he ends up sort of reproducing some of the objectionable principles of 19th century psychology instead of sort of having a critical analysis of the observations of animal behavior and sort of being deliberately selective of, you know, what forms of explanation he's going to appeal to. What he's arguing here, what Maître Ponty is arguing here, is that we have to, when we're doing, when we're trying to explain behavior, we should actually start from a concrete description of that behavior and not from a sort of quasi-physiological language translation of that description. So we should look at how animals, and including humans, respond to concrete situations, what types of behavior they exhibit in certain situations, and so on. We should start from there, and then try to give our explanation. And we should be aware that what we're doing is kind of a theoretical construction, as opposed to the way Pavlov does things. He starts from some very strong hypotheses, so the very restrictive hypotheses about how the nervous system functions, that have no experimental justification, or at least in the time he was writing had no experimental justification. So he presupposes how he thinks the nervous system functions, and then on the basis of that presupposition, he tries to explain the more complicated behavior of other animals and of humans. But he's not aware that those presuppositions are in fact presuppositions. He thinks he's just sort of describing in physiological terms what organisms do. So, again, this sort of conscious awareness that what we're doing is a theoretical construction is important, so that we can have a sort of critical analysis of our own presuppositions and of the presuppositions of other theories.
Yeah, I think this last bit that we read is a really good summary of of the argumentation that he's making. Specifically for me, the very interesting part is not simply that we are attacking the, or quote-unquote attacking, I guess, criticizing the supposed scientific or more scientific method of, you know, physiology. But this little part at the end where he states that a purely descriptive psychology or psychological approach that is aware of its own purely descriptive character would be preferable, right? It's a very interesting defense of psychology in relation to this issue.
Yeah, and this is connected to some of what we discussed in the last couple of sessions, in relation to experimental studies of animal behavior versus naturalistic studies of animal behavior, so ethology and so on. So one of the sort of standard criticisms, and Maître Ponty sort of shares this criticism of people like Pavlov, is that when you do these experiments with dogs in a lab and you give them meat powder and measure their salivation and so on, you're producing, you can produce these effects, but it's a very artificial sort of situation, and it doesn't really tell us anything about, you know, how dogs actually behave in their sort of normal environment. And so this criticism that Maître Ponty is developing here is along similar lines, and is saying that essentially that the descriptive aspect that we find in naturalistic analyses of animal behavior, so studying animals in their natural environment and not in an experimental setting, this sort of descriptive nature of the types of studies is something that's really unavoidable. And so we can either do it deliberately, or we can sort of pretend we're not doing it, but we're doing it either way. And so even someone like Pavlov, who claims to be sort of bypassing the purely descriptive or purely psychological sort of element of behavior, of the analysis of behavior, what he's doing instead is like presupposing some of these principles of 19th century psychology that are probably not valid, or that are at least open to a lot of objections, but he's sort of presupposing them without realizing that he's presupposing them. And so instead, if we deliberately start from this descriptive psychological sort of explanation or mode of description of animal behavior, then we sort of know what we're doing. We can be aware of what we're presupposing in our descriptions, and it gives us more sort of control over what it is that we're actually postulating when we describe and then try to explain animal behavior. So it's a it's a pretty, I think, sophisticated argument. It's not just saying, you know, Pavlov is wrong about A, B, and C, but he's saying that, you know, the whole sort of approach that Pavlov is taking is bound to lead to bad explanations just because he's not aware of what he's doing. And so we have to be, more sort of deliberate about what it is that we're doing, and then we can have a better understanding of the presuppositions we're making. Okay, were there any other questions or comments on that last bit before we move on? Okay, so can I get a volunteer to read the next page in a bit?
Yeah, you can read. We're starting the central sector of behavior, right?
Yes, exactly, at the section break.
Wait, the central sector, quote-unquote, of behavior and the problem of localization. The atomistic postulates which oblige Pavlov to consider a complex excitant as the sum of simple excitants excludes the notion of receptive coordination from nerve physiology. The model of nerve action is sought in the quote-unquote elementary process which associates a simple reaction to an isolated process. Since there is a one-to-one correspondence between them, the physiological substrate of the reaction is imagined in the form of connections or disjunction, and the point of arrival of the excitation are marked on the map of the brain. The positive and negative reactions which are observed are actualized in points of positive and negative innervation. If we move to more complex reactions, different stimuli will be found in competition at the level of these points, but their acquired powers will be combined only by an algebraic summation. Their union can only permit or prohibit, reinforce or attenuate, but not modify qualitatively the reaction governed by the point of innervation. Pavlov's physiology excludes the idea of motor coordination in the same way. The excitation or inhibition of the innervation points of which we just spoke indeed depends on what happens in the rest of the cortex. The reciprocal induction and proprioceptive conditioning of a reaction by the one which precedes it are indeed, open quotes, transverse functions, end quotes. But although reciprocal induction gives a local phenomenon the power of inhibiting another, it does not permit the one to modify the other qualitatively. Thus, it does not provide the instrument of a flexible regulation. Although the conditioning of a reaction by the preceding one makes it understandable that real fragments of behavior can be joined to each other or disassociated, it cannot render possible the adaptation of the parts to each other, such as in the rhythmic organization, which is so remarkable in verbal behavior. Here he opens quotes. In virtue of the fact that, in the waking state, these two processes, excitation and inhibition, are mutually limiting, an immense mosaic is produced in the cerebral hemispheres in which stimulated points on the one hand and points which are inhibited and in temporary state of sleep on the other are found next to each other. The presence of these intermingled points, now stimulated, now sleeping, determines the entire behavior of the animal, end quotes. As in the older conception of localizations, nerve phenomena constitute a mosaic, and nerve activity is never an autonomous process of distribution. To the theory of conditioned reflexes, as to the classical theory of reflexes, his questions must be posed. In nerve phenomena, open quotes, are we dealing in reality with functions of the structure or with functional structure, end quotes. In particular, the nervous system will direct behavior by an action comparable to that of the rudder of a boat or the steering wheel of an automobile. The directing organ would exercise a quasi-mechanical action. Thus, only one position of this organ would be possible for a given direction of walking. This conception of nerve functioning is in any case applicable only to the cerebral cortex, where the afferent and efferent nerve fibers are punctually projected. The existence of conditioned motor reactions in fish which do not have a cerebral cortex, or even in invertebrates and down to the protozoa, suggests that these reactions are not linked to any particular anatomical device, and that they must express a general property of nerve phenomena, or even of biological phenomena. But with regard to the functioning of the cortex itself, does modern physiology move in the direction of Pavlov? So, do I keep going?
We can stop here, actually. Yeah, I think that's fine.
The more, I guess, technical aspects of this paragraph elude me a bit. The afferent and efferent nerve fibers.
Just on that last bit. So afferent and efferent are the two directions of in the standard theory of nerve functioning. So afferent fibers or afferent direction of travel of stimulation is the direction that goes from the periphery, so sense organs like the skin or the eyes or whatever, it goes from the periphery towards the brain, so from the periphery to the center of the organism in some sense. And then efferent are the nerve responses that go in the other direction, so from the brain to the muscles or other peripheral elements. Afferent comes from the periphery towards the brain, and then efferent goes from the brain to the periphery. That's what those terms mean.
Right, I see. Yeah, that's clear. That makes sense.
So the general, so he's here looking at, he's sort of passing from this reflex theory of Pavlov, and he's comparing it or looking at how it connects with the theory of localization in the brain. And so this is like still today is a very important notion of brain functioning. So it's not the case that every aspect of the brain is involved in every sort of aspect of behavior. Of course, various parts of the brain are responsible or involved in any sort of more complex behavior like speech or something like that. But at the same time, there is some degree of specialization of different parts of the brain in different functions. And in particular, there are these what's sometimes called topographical maps in the brain. So for example, the motor areas of the brain, you can actually sort of draw a map of which parts of the body different parts of the motor areas correspond to. It's not a sort of one-to-one map, because like certain areas like your hands or your tongue are much more sensitive, much more flexible than, say, like your legs or your lower back or something. So the areas that are more flexible, that have a greater degree of control of movement, these areas correspond to much bigger parts of the brain, whereas areas like your lower back that have only a very limited degree of movement would have a very small representation in the brain. So it's a sort of distorted picture of the human body that you can draw on the brain as like a representation of the motor capacities of the human body. But it's still some degree of localization. So like different parts of the brain have different functions or correspond to different portions of the body, for example. There's a lot of research today as well into, you know, sort of looking at different parts of the brain and trying to figure out what specializations they have, what are the particular tasks in which those areas of the brain are involved and not in others. But of course, this research was much less advanced in the 1920s or 30s compared to what it is today. They didn't have, for example, functional MRI like we have today. All of this was done basically on guesswork, like based on the anatomy of the brain, dissecting dead animals or human beings, and then looking at where nerve fibers were ending up in the brain or where they were leaving from in the brain, and trying to sort of guess what functions they were involved in. It was much less developed at that time, but there was still this general conception that that different parts of the brain had different roles to play in different types of behavior. In correspondence with Pavlov's theory, so Pavlov posits that there are these inhibitory and excitatory reactions to stimuli. Likewise, this sort of localization theory posits that there are positive and negative innervations. So there will be certain nerve endings or nerve fibers that end at the brain at a positive point that excite a response, and then there will be other nerve fibers that end at a negative point in the brain, and so they inhibit a response. So there's a sort of relatively straightforward correspondence between the reflex theory that Pavlov is developing and this localization theory that sort of posits positive and negative regions in the brain. And then the question that arises, or the difficulty that arises, is that when you start combining stimuli, like in the examples that he gave in the last section, when you have like complex stimuli, like a melody or two stimuli presented at the same time, etc., you can bring about these strange responses where like two stimuli together are inhibitory, but then each one on its own is excitatory, or vice versa. And so, like, if these fibers have like positive or negative innervation in the brain, then it's hard to understand how like combining two inhibitory stimuli, like two fibers that end in inhibitory areas of the brain, how that combination would produce excitation or vice versa. So it's very this sort of very simple idea of how localization of the brain works is hard to connect with the experimental results of what conditioning actually realizes in animals. And then maybe a more serious objection, or a more difficult objection, is the fact that animal behavior, even something simple like walking, is not just a sequence of individual sort of punctual responses. What we haven't said is a coordination of various elements. So walking involves obviously a whole set of muscles, and not just one muscle responding to one stimulus. So each of the muscles of your leg has to contract and extend in a precise sequence, so that your leg actually lifts up from the ground, moves forward, and then touches the ground again, and you have to maintain your balance during this whole exercise. So there's all sorts of muscles in your legs, in your torso, etc., that are all involved in coordination to produce this rhythmic pattern of walking. And so this whole coordination side of things is something that there's really no place for in this very simple localization theory. If everything in the cortex is just a matter of positive and negative areas of the brain that fibers sort of end up at, then there's no element in the brain that would sort of play the role of ensuring that the different elements, the different muscle contractions and so on, are coordinated in the rhythmic way that they have to be to actually make an organism walk. And then the next bit, the last bit that we just saw here, is a pretty interesting suggestion about how the cerebral cortex doesn't even seem to be necessary for... So the first bit shows that cerebral cortex is not sufficient. Just having innervations that are inhibitory or excitatory in the cerebral cortex doesn't give us enough to explain even relatively simple behavior like walking. But it also doesn't seem to be necessary, because you can exhibit conditioned reactions in invertebrates that don't even have a cerebral cortex. And there's been much more study of this, you know, since this time. You can train worms, for example, to respond to stimuli of various kinds, chemicals, I think, concentrations of chemicals in the soil. Bees are capable of learning, various other insects. So these are organisms that have no cerebral cortex whatsoever, and have a much smaller brain than humans or dogs or rats do. But they're still capable of learning. So obviously, a cerebral cortex is not necessary for learning. And whatever it is that they're doing when they learn is not something that we can explain purely in terms of the structure of the cerebral cortex. So he mentions just in passing that even protozoa, so single-celled organisms, there's been, like, in the past, 10, 15, 20 years or so, a lot of research on something like cognition in single-celled organisms. It's not just the case that single-celled organisms respond in like a mechanical way to chemical stimuli or light or these other physical effects. What you find instead is that they integrate information coming from various sources and exhibit a response that is appropriate to the situation as a whole. This whole area of research in what's called basal cognition. So very cognition in very simple organisms that, in the case of single-celled organisms, don't even have a nervous system. There's like group behavior of certain kinds of bacteria, for example, and amoeba, that like they have a sort of free-swimming state in certain conditions. And then if there's not enough food in the environment, for example, they will collect together and form like a kind of stem structure, and then disperse spores to sort of seek out new environments. There's This is obviously a pretty sophisticated behavioral response to a surrounding basal cognition.
I was actually taking a class on this one, but I'm still an undergraduate, so the professor didn't explain on this. And apparently, some of those cells, they will decide to become the stem that spread the spores, and then those cells will die. And that is a non-heritable portion of the whole collective. So they have this emergent behavior, like maybe it's called that. But basically, all of these fungus, some of them will decide to self-sacrifice, that's the point, to become the stem for these pore structures, while only some genital cells are able to pass down their genetic information. This is like a non-heritable altruism that just pops up here and there all the time in different kind of like smaller cells. But this one is in fungus, so maybe it's not that much of a single cell, but it's definitely like not like consciousness level cognition, you know. I asked my professor, and the professor says nobody in the university is studying this.
Yeah, it's relatively small field, I think, in terms of like the number of people studying it. But yeah, fungi, so I think slime molds are an example of this. But yeah, so there's like, in fungi, you can find these behaviors where they exhibit like this very differentiated response to situations. So again, not just a very simple, X amount of chemical Y produces response A, and then and in a very sort of mechanistic sense, but instead you have like integrating information like light sensitivity, chemical sensitivity, the direction of gravity, like integrating all this information, and then producing an adaptive response, or a response that sort of makes sense in that situation and allows the organism to survive and reproduce and so on. That depends on all these different sorts of information. And so this, like, if we saw this kind of behavior in a rat or even a fish or something, we would say this is cognition. It's you know, thinking, or it's taking information in about the environment and exhibiting an appropriate response. This is a cognitive sort of process. But in the case of, you know, plants or bacteria or fungi, it does seem, it feels sort of awkward to describe this as cognition, but there's no sort of principled reason why we shouldn't call it cognition just because it's happening in organisms that don't have a nervous system. But yeah, so Mechlopontsi here is just sort of pointing to the fact that there are these like responses that are very similar to what we would call cognition, or, you know, these sort of sophisticated responses to multiple sources of information coming from the environment, even in organisms that don't have a cerebral cortex or a nervous system at all. Again, it can't be the case that it's just the structure of the cerebral cortex and this sort of reciprocal induction process in the cerebral cortex and so on that is responsible for sophisticated behavior, if we can find this sophisticated behavior in organisms that don't have a nervous system at all. So that suggests that even in, say, rats or dogs or humans, we don't have to suppose that it's precisely this structure of the cerebral cortex that is responsible for sophisticated behavior. It sort of, I guess, frees us from that hypothesis or presupposition that it has to be this particular structure of the cerebral cortex that brings about the kind of cognition that we recognize in what we sometimes call higher animals, or animals that are like more familiar to us. So any other questions or comments about that last bit? Okay, so I'm going to suggest that we stop here for today, since we're about at time, and we can pick up on the next bit at the next meeting, if that works for everyone.
Yeah, that works for me.
Cool. Okay, so thanks everyone for coming out. Yeah, thanks for questions and comments and so on. It's always great to have engagement from everyone, so hope to see you all next week.